Today's episode is sponsored by Craftsy. Calling all crafters, are you ready to dive deep into your favorite crafting projects and learn new techniques along the way? Then it's time to join Craftsy Premium Membership. Take advantage of this special promotion. For only $1.49, you'll receive a full year of access to expert-led tutorials, patterns, and projects in every category you can imagine. With a massive library of resources at your fingertips, you'll be able to create your best work yet and bring your crafting dreams to life. Don't wait. Sign up now at craftsyoffers.com and discover the endless possibilities of Craftsy Premium Membership. Thank you so much, Craftsy. And now, here's the show. Welcome to episode 262 of the Craft Industry Alliance podcast. I'm Abby Glassenberg. Craft Industry Alliance is a community for craft professionals where you can strengthen your creative business, stay up to date on industry news, and build connections within our supportive trade association. Check it out at craftindustryalliance.org. Today on the show, we're talking about buttons with my guest, Bo McCall. Proclaimed by American Craft Magazine as the Button Man, Bo McCall creates wearable and visual art by applying clothing buttons onto mostly upcycled fabrics, materials, and objects. His artwork offers commentary on topics such as pop culture and social justice. On March 30th, his first ever retrospective exhibition debuts at the Fuller Craft Museum, titled Bo McCall, Buttons On. Bo McCall, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Great. So glad to have you on the show. I love your work and I'm really excited to talk with you. So I know you were born in Philadelphia. Can you tell us a little bit about what you were like as a kid, what your household was like? Were you always kind of a creative maker?
Well, I grew up in public housing in South Philadelphia. My mother was a homemaker. And my dad worked in a pencil company. And at early on, my second brother and I, we went to Catholic school. So my father worked in the pencil company. So we had pencils with our names on it. So we thought that was a big deal. And then a couple times a year, my dad would donate pencils to the school. As a kid, I was a very shy kid. I was the eldest child. Very shy. Very much a homebody, you know, still trying to discover, you know, when you're a kid, who you are as a person, where you fit in the neighborhood, where you fit in school. So I mostly stayed home, and we were very close to my neighbors who lived across the hall. So for a while, that was my extent of being social outside of my family. One thing I did pick up on, first of all, both of my parents were very stylish, very regal in how they presented themselves. So Philly is a very conservative town, and then going to Catholic school, that sort of all lined up together. So I was a child of the 60s, and you know, when the I guess when the free love explosion started. You know, it was Hendrix and Janis Joplin and the Black Panthers and all kind of things was going on in the country. And at an early age, I was attracted to music. And my parents, they only listened to jazz music. So I considered that music their music. And it wasn't until I got exposed to Sly and the Family Stones that I started to, like, crack my own shell and being exposed to other types of music. But anyway, my mother was attracted to decorating. And in decorating, she was very contemporary in the moment. Because most of the times when you went to Black folks' house at that point in time, everything looked the same. It was the big old bulky sofas and muted colors and, you know, the Jesus pictures in the house and my mom was like on the edge. She liked like a lot of bright colors. We had a few Picasso prints and she loved Modigliani. And she was upcycling before upcycling was a thing. So, you know, she would see stuff on the trash and my brother and myself would have to go pick it up and bring it back and she would clean it up. And, you know, it became a part of the decor. So I think that's where my creative bug started. I didn't know at the time what I was tapping into. Early on, you know, my brothers was more outgoing, more athletic. I did not get that gene. So, you know, I had to figure out a way to sort of use my time like after school. So we went to after school programs and, you know, I learned how to weave. I learned how to macrame. We did tie dye. We did all kind of creative craft things. So I was attracted to that. So that kind of opened the door up to me expressing my artistic behavior. And then they also took us to on field trips to museums. And from there, I was attracted to that. I guess the artistic value of what I was seeing, I really didn't know at the time because I was so young, but I was attracted to that. So I continued going after, you know, the program ceased. I continued going. And then they were in walking distance from where we live. So, you know, maybe a couple times a month, I would go to the art museum or the science museum, whatever, just to kill time and just to, you know, see what was going on in the world. So it kind of started like that. And then one of my aunts, she was creative. So we used to make jewelry out of bones. So whatever we would eat, if we had spare ribs, pork chops, chicken, we would save the bones. And I can't remember the process, but it was a process that we would go through to preserve the bone and make this neckwear out of. And then we would make things, these little toothpick name tags with alphabet pasta. Mm-hmm. Like she and I, we did a lot of stuff. And then my mom, she always encouraged it. She never told me that I couldn't do it, or they never tried to like force me to be athletic because, you know, you're a boy. This is what boys do. They should have just let me go with the flow and, you know, express my own energy in my own way. So I think creatively, it started with her and, you know, her color combinations and how she would decorate our apartment. I remember one year, this is when contact paper was all the rage. My mother went out and came back and she had this roll of black and white check herringbone glossy contact paper. So our kitchen was herringbone black and white checks. Like nobody in the building had a kitchen like that. And then I think we had this flowered orange colored sofa one year. And then we had like a real loud reddish color sofa with this orange chair. And she was into chrome and glass and mobiles. And we had this little knickknack. It was this giant jack, like the game of Jack's ball and jack. Mm-hmm. We had this giant jack that sat on a coffee table. And then we had the Wassily chair. Mm-hmm. So people would come to our house and be like, what is this?
Right.
And she hated for people to pick up things and touch her knickknacks. She like, don't touch it. Don't touch it. If you want to know what it is, I'll tell you what it is or whatever. But she would have a fit if you touched anything. And it was just interesting. And at the time, you know, I didn't know she was off the path. I just, you know.
Yeah, that's all you liked. Know.
Yeah, right. That's all I knew at the time. So it kind of started there. And then I started, I recently talked about when now they have all these processed genes with all these different treatments and stuff. But back then we used to bleach our genes and make all different types of patterns with the bleach. And do you remember when Flo Jo, she used to run in that outfit with one leg? Well, this was like maybe late 60s, early 70s. You know, I cut my jeans off like that.
Wow.
And I'm like, she stole that from me. She got all the credit.
Yeah, that was her signature look, the one-legged leggings. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did that many moons before she did. And then I remember, I don't know if you remember, oh God, Tandy's. It was like a leather goods store.
Yeah.
American Handicraft. And they sold beads. And I used to make these necklaces out of these seed beads. And they would have kits, leather kits to make wallets and little fringe bags. So I was attracted to that. And then they had a program in the basement with these senior ladies on. They was teaching you how to macrame. Well, I learned how to macrame from the after school program. So I went thinking that, you know, it was going to be a bunch of kids, but it was a bunch of senior ladies. So I ended up teaching them some of the things that I've learned, you know, through the program. So that was kind of fun. So I went through all these different transitions before I actually settled on a button, because every couple of weeks or every couple of months, I would say to my mom, "Oh, I want to do this," and she just go run out and get the supplies, and I would do that until I got bored.
Right. Yeah. So you were really experimenting, and I know there was a story I read about when I was doing some research about you about a pair of sandals. I don't know if you can tell us that story.
This is like my earliest recollection of being creative and being denied something that I really want. So my mom had these T-strap sandals that, you know, the strap goes between your toes, across your foot and around your ankle. You know, in my head, I wasn't thinking gender. I wasn't thinking male or female, boy, girl. I just liked the sandals, and I wanted a pair. And I said to my mom, I said, "Oh, you know, I'm one of those, a pair of those sandals that you're wearing." So she's like, "Oh no, these are for girls. These are for women. You cannot have these. They don't make these for men." So I'm looking at her like, it's a shoe, like a shoe. Does a shoe really have a gender? Does a shoe really have a sex? So I was kind of like, a little annoyed with the answer, right? So this was during the time when the telephone people came to your house to install phones. They would install your phone, and then they would leave all this wire behind, right? So every summer, my brother and I, we would get a new pair of kids. So it would either be a blue pair of kids or a red pair of kids. And then, you know, we would hold on to the old pair until they just wore out, wear them around the house or in the building. And I went and got my old pair of blue kids, and I cut the top of the sneaker off, which was the cloth part. And then I ripped out the padding, which was the inner sole. And I got the telephone wire, and I started braiding and weaving the straps together. And, you know, I got my good old Elmer's glue. And, you know, I measured the wire through my toes and across my foot and my ankle and what have you. And I glued everything down and put the inner sole back in and waited till they dried. And I went back to my mom. I said, "Look, Mom, these are boy sandals." So she was like in amazement. And, you know, she called everybody in the family, "Oh, he just made a pair of sandals, da, 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 da." So I'm like, "They're boy sandals now because I made them."
Right.
Like, come on now, you know? So it was a lot of things like that. And then one of my cousins, she was the only girl for a long, long time. She was surrounded by all these boys, right? And I remember a few times, it might have been a sweater or a blouse or something. And this is before they really started branding things as unisex. Mm-hmm. But some of the stuff that were coming, that was influenced by the hippies and influenced by the rock generations, the lines were blurred. So when I would see stuff, I'd be like, "Oh, I could wear that. I could wear that." So a few things that she turned down, I took and I wore.
Yeah.
So You know, it was just a series of just finding out who I was as a person and finding out how far I could push my creativity and where, you know, I fit in within those boundaries.
Right, right. Okay. So after high school, you moved to New York.
Yes.
And talk about those early days in New York and, you know, what you were seeking when you got there and then what you ended up doing.
Okay. So let me take you to the button before we get to New York. So we moved. We moved into a house and we were there for a couple years. And my mom had a jar of buttons in the basement. Like everybody's mother or grandmother has a jar of buttons or that little Danish blue tin can or a cigar box in the house filled with buttons. So we had this Maxwell House jar of buttons. And, you know, I really didn't give it much attention. And then this one particular day, I was ironing and the jar was eye level. So I tell people that I started to have an engagement with this jar of buttons. Like we started to have this unspoken dialogue, me and the jar. So, you know, that went on for a couple of weeks. And then I started to explore the jar, open it up and, you know, find out what kind of types of buttons was in there. And it was all types of buttons. And my mom had bought this, this black sweater. So I got the idea, well, maybe I should use the buttons to embellish this sweater. So now, mind you, at the time, I had no technique. I had no guideline. I just know I wanted to apply these buttons to the sweater. And I started working on the sweater. And then when my mom saw that I gravitated towards this jar of buttons, she started going out and collecting buttons for me so I could complete the sweater, right? So I completed the sweater in about 6 months. And I wore it out to a club. And
it was just covered in buttons.
It was covered in buttons. Everything except for the sleeve. So at this point, I had no technique. I was just randomly sewing buttons. But as you know, as the buttons started to appear and I started to create this pattern, I got more in tune with what I was doing. So by the time I got finished, I was like, I really like this. And then it made a lot of noise when you picked it up. And even when I put it on and in motion, it was like a bag of keys that the maintenance man would have. And you would see them come up with this large hook and all these keys. It just made all this noise. And I loved the sound that it made. So I wore it out, got rave reviews, and I came back and I got so much attention. I had a sweater vest. So I did the same thing to the sweater vest. And then I decided to move to New York. And I moved to New York with the intent on doing something creative. Now, what that was going to be, I had no idea.
Yeah.
So when I got here, when I arrived here, a friend of mine that lived in the neighborhood, I stayed with him for about 6 months. And at this time, they had a festival called Harlem Week on 125th Street. So it was from one end of Harlem to the other end of the Harlem. And, you know, they had all kind of entertainment. They had vendors. The Apollo was going on. Everything was just happening all at once at this festival. And this was the first time that I've seen a sea of Black people, of beautiful Black folks, and smack dab in the middle of 125th Street. So I thought it was beautiful. So I go, and somebody takes me to the State Building, and it's this fashion show called Uptown Saturday Night. The show starts, there's all Black designers, there's all Black models, and then later on I found out there was all Black administrators, and then it was the brainchild of Lois Alexander. Okay, so I see that, and I tell the person that I'm with, I said, next year I'm going to be a part of this. So, of course, you know, they laugh me off, like, sure, you're always dreaming about whatever, right? So I went out, and I started sourcing denim denim jackets, denim shorts. And this, again, before people really made upcycling a thing, you hadn't heard about it on the level that I was doing it. And I didn't really think twice about it. I just did what I did. And I really don't call myself a designer. I call myself a creative, because a designer kind of pigeonholes you into one spot, right? A creative, I can open up many doors.
I want to take a moment now to talk about our sponsor, Craftsy. And here is a message from Craftsy. At Craftsy, we know making. Whether you're new to the handmade life or looking to advance your skills, we have classes for all maker levels and interests. From knitting and sewing to quilting and embroidery, cooking, baking, paper crafts, and more, Craftsy's instructors guide and encourage you, empowering you to turn ideas into realities. And they have an exclusive offer for Craft Industry Alliance podcast listeners. Right now, you can get a whole year of their premium membership for only $1.49. Visit craftsyoffers.com to sign up, and the discount will be automatically applied at checkout. For only $1.49, you'll get a full year of access to over 2,000 premium full-length classes. Take your craft to new levels this year with Craftsy. If you're an absolute beginner, Craftsy's instructors help build strong foundations as they teach, setting you up for success and helping you fix mistakes as you go. Their enthusiasm and strong teaching style make learning accessible to all. If you're an experienced maker, make the resolution to improve your skills in the upcoming year. Craftsy is for you too. From perfecting your fondant skills to tackling complex stitches, from eye-catching garden design to next steps in sourdough, Craftsy has advanced classes in all crafts from instructors who are experts in their field. With over 2,000 classes, including downloadable patterns and recipes, Craftsy has a class and a craft for everyone. So visit craftsyoffers.com today and get a year of Craftsy premium membership for just $1.49. Don't miss out on 99% off for the entire year. Start turning ideas into projects you can be proud of. Get this exclusive offer at craftsyoffers.com. Thank you so much, Craftsy. And now back to my conversation with Bo.
So I started working on this collection. And a friend of mine from back home who also moved to New York City, he called me, he said, the Fashion Institute, they're holding auditions for, you know, the shows that's coming up for Harlem Week. Are you still working on your collection? So, yes. So I go around with my duffel bag. I might have had maybe a dozen pieces. I get online. It's my turn. I meet this man named George Alexander. Young man, you know, let me see your wares. Let me see what you have. And, you know, explain to us, you know, what you're doing. So I take my stuff out the bag and they're like in awe, like, oh, did you hand sew all these? Is this all your work? Blah, 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 blah. So it was maybe it might have been 20 minutes, half hour conversation to talk about my work. And they asked me how soon could I start? And they were, I think the show started that weekend immediately. So I started then, which ended up to be like an almost 10-year run with them. So they were the first folks at the Harlem Institute to really feature and give me a platform to express myself artistically. Now, at the same time, I still didn't want to be known as a designer, because most of the people that I ended up being in the collective with, they were making things from scratch. And from the beginning, I was a little...
You were embellishing.
I was just doing an embellishing stuff. So it was a lot of whispers like, oh, you know, he's not a designer. Oh. He's not a real designer. He's just sewing buttons. And so I was very insecure about that for a minute.
Sure.
And maybe about 2 or 3 years in, Women's Wear Daily came around and they featured an article on me. So that's where my confidence came in. Well, Women's Wear Daily is recognizing me as an artist, as a designer, then that's the Bible of fashion. So I'm going to go with that. So,
and your work at that time was like denim that you were getting that was already made, that you, and you were sewing buttons all over it or in patterns, or what did it look like?
So it was it was mostly pattern. So it could be, I did a lot of color blocking. At the time, my mom was still collecting buttons for me, you know, my family, people on the block. I was still getting like donations from Philly. So color wise, things were very limited. Because most right. buttons, they look like the white shirt buttons mm-hmm. or the tortoise buttons on an overcoat or a suit. Yeah. So I had to figure out a way to elevate just the plain old dull button. So I started using embroidery thread in bold colors. So it would make the button pop. It would take it to another level.
I see.
And then... you know, I started using different color combinations. I started separating the buttons. I would separate the wood buttons, leather buttons, glass, plastic, mother of pearl. And then in the process, I realized that they all had their own distinctive sound. Mm. So, you know, while I was in the process of working and I would dig my hand in a jar or a box or whatever, there were times where I could just click buttons together and I could tell you what it was made of from just repetition, listening to these sounds over and over and over again. You know, I started color blocking. I started making different patterns. I started investigating the garment district. And at that time in the garment district, I could go in one of those buildings and just push a button on any floor and the elevator, the door would open. It will be rooms filled yeah. with buttons from floor to ceiling and just rows and rows of boxes and boxes of buttons. So I got fixated on that, just going out, sourcing buttons and not knowing what I was going to find. And by the time I got back home, you know, I would have my vintage buttons, my donated buttons, and then the new buttons that I bought that I incorporated to, come up with all these different patterns and what have you. And then as time went on, like now, most of those places don't exist anymore.
I know. Yeah.
Right. And then not too long ago before they went out of business, I found a place where you could actually have buttons dyed.
Right. So how does that work? What are they made from? Are they plastic or are they something else?
It's some kind of plastic and synthetic.
Okay.
And the process is very primitive. They were in this little small room. You bring them a swatch of whatever color that you're looking for. They had these huge pots. I call them Flintstone pots. They was these enormous pots and these big giant spoons, like you're watching the Flintstones. And then, you know, they would take the dye and, you know, make the color that you want, stir it up and do a little test and, you know, show you. Is this, you know, is this correct? Is this precise? And, you know, you'd okay it. And then they stir it up. They'd be ready in all of maybe 15 minutes.
Wow.
And the process was really quick. But moving forward, a lot of places, they were closing. And
yeah,
they never told me that they were closing. I went one day, I got my order, and I went back the next week. They went out of business.
Oh, no. Oh, gosh.
Then there was this another place. I don't know whether you're familiar with Tender Buttons. At one time, they had the best buttons in the city. You could buy a button from a quarter to a couple hundred dollars. Beautiful, handcrafted, hand-carved buttons. Any theme that you were looking for, they had it. I went and made, you know, my usual purchases and I got a chance to know one of the ladies there. And that one time that she mentioned that they were closing. And I went back a couple weeks later, they were closed. Yeah. And then I ran into her on the street one day and she said that the owner lived upstairs. And she said, she just came downstairs one day and said, we're closing. And she said, they immediately start packing up. So wow. Now, my go-to place is a place called Lulu Buttons. I have a great relationship with the owner, Roz. He has great buttons from A to Z, you name it, he has it. And if he doesn't have it, he's a button maker. So he can make whatever it is that I'm looking for.
Okay. And that's in that Lulu Buttons in New York City. Is it in the Garment District?
Yes.
Okay. So if folks want to go and check that out, that's a good recommendation coming straight from you. So.
Yes. And he's easy to talk to.
Yeah.
People come in, you know, he works with Broadway. He does buttons, sure. You know, the theater productions, yeah. And the New York designer. So he's well versed,
cool.
In,
yeah,
you know, who he deals with in the fashion community. And then, you know, he has artists like myself come in.
Sure, sure. And during these early years in New York, how were you supporting yourself? Were you able to support yourself on this artwork, or were you working a day job?
I had a day job.
Okay.
I had a day job, and when I got into the collective with the Harlem Fashion Institute, most of those folks, they were already established, right? So for me, I was starting from scratch.
Right.
As far as my creativity, like, I've been creative damn near all my life, but I wasn't on a level of showing work publicly. So most of the stuff I would do for myself. I would make for family members, make for my close friends, but I hadn't been in a situation. Maybe once my dad, when I was a kid, maybe I was maybe like 10 or 11 years old, they had some kind of carnival, and I made some of these little macrame pieces to sell. But prior to that, most of the stuff was for myself. You know, I'm my own best model. So when I got here, when I got to New York, it just opened up a whole new world for me, because I was able to be around other creatives. I was able to speak my language and learn a language, and as far as being creative and finding different outlets and different sources to express my creativity on how to find things. Because I knew about the Garment District, but I didn't know how to approach the Garment District.
Navigate it, yeah.
Right. So, you know, I would go with some of them, and, you know, they would introduce me to different little spots and stuff. They would go.
It's like learning the language. Yeah, like learning the language of navigating all of this. It's a whole different world. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So I went through that, and then after I got the hang of it, you know, I would just go on my own and discover places.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and then I know in the 80s, when the AIDS crisis hit, it really hit you hard as far as your emotional well-being with friends and seeing all the suffering around you.
Yeah. So that was another, like, life happened. For a minute there, I was very, very focused. And then when I would call home to Philadelphia, all of my friends were dying. And it kind of left me numb for a very, very long time. I thought, you know, I was going to heal and move on, but it sort of just stayed with me, because it was consecutive. It was just happened one after another. Every couple of weeks, somebody I knew died. And then when it really hit me hard, it was people from my own circle. So it was AIDS. There was a murder. There was a suicide. There was diabetes. Just all these things just start happening all at one time. Mm-hmm. And these were the guys that I came out with. These were the guys that I experienced my gay life with and navigated through. That's a whole nother conversation. You know, I had some special times with them. I have special memories with them, special stories. And I always tell people, I really thought we were going to be old together. I really thought that we was going to be in some senior place rolling each other around in wheelchairs. And it didn't happen. And then one of my last friends, he was still in Philly at the time, and when he would come to visit, we would always have this conversation of, who's going to be the last one to tell the story? And it ended up being me.
Yeah.
you know, and even when I, you know, reminisce and rewind and start telling the story, it's very joyous, but at the same time, it's very painful. You just like with next week coming, and I got this, you know, this huge retrospective coming up, and yeah. they'll be there in spirit, but they're not here to really in the physical to enjoy this with me.
Yeah. You know? It's really sad. Yeah. Yeah. And then I know you met your life partner, and that was a way sort of to be uplifted and to sort of reconnect, it sounds like creatively for you.
Right. So with my life partner, we've been together for 14 years. We met online 14 years ago, and we went out on a date, and we just became inseparable. And then he was the first person outside of my family who really understood me creatively. So okay. In the beginning, when we were getting to know each other, and, you know, we're probing each other, asking each other different questions. And, you know, he asked me, what did I do? And at the time, I really wasn't comfortable saying that I was an artist. Mm-hmm. So I started showing him some of the works that I had in my closet stored away from maybe 10, 15 years prior to meeting him. And he, you know, he looked at all the works and he just looked at me and said, so what are you going to do with all this stuff? And, you know, he kind of caught me off guard. And, you know, we just went on and processed the information, had more conversations. And then he said to me one day, at the time he was a journalist. And he said, oh, well, I have some connections. I think I can curate an art exhibit. Would you be interested? So I said, yeah. And this, like I said, this was 14 years ago. And, you know, he found all the artists. He did all the paperwork. He found the location. And I created this piece called Until We're Free. And we did the show, and we had Danny Simmons as our featured artist, and people came. And it was almost like, you know, in every city, there's an art scene somewhere. And people are established. We didn't know anybody. So he said that we should create our own events and develop our own venues instead of just waiting for people to come around and say, oh, you want to take part in this? You want to participate in that?
Right. I love that. And, yeah.
Most of the time that didn't happen because we didn't know anybody. And then as we started to infiltrate the art scene and people started becoming familiar with him as a curator and me as an artist, the door started opening, but he still kept curating. And, you know, every opportunity got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Right.
So it worked out.
And Until We're Free, what did that piece look like?
Until We're Free is my version of the American flag. It's two flags combined into one. So there's the American flag and there's the Pan-African flag. So that was the very first piece that I created for visual art. And I wanted to come back with a strong message. So the piece, it references the two worlds that me as a Black person and even as a Black gay man, that I have to navigate being a Black man in America. Mm-hmm. So I have to deal with the racism on the red, white, and blue side. And then on the red, black, and green side, I can be my whole self because it's people who are walking in the same shoes, in the same lifestyle as I'm living on a daily basis. So it addresses that, and it's based on a song by Elaine Brown, who was a member of the Black Panthers.
Okay.
So it started like that. So I wanted something with a strong message and something very powerful to like get the ball rolling and get people to pay attention to my work.
And is that piece made with buttons?
Everything I do is made with buttons.
Everything.
Very first one. Yes. 90%. Yeah. 90% of, no, matter of fact, 95% of what I do is predominantly buttons. Mm-hmm. And I would say 90% of it is on denim. Denim is a work of fabric, and denim, it can sustain the weight of the button.
Right. Some
of the
pieces, it can hold it.
Yeah. Right. And some of the pieces go from maybe 5 pounds to 100, 200, 300 pounds.
Right. Right. So tell us about some of the other pieces that maybe are significant in your mind that you've made over the years that might be sort of highlights of this upcoming retrospective at the Fuller Craft Museum.
Okay, so I've done this piece called World Spinning on a 45. And people of a certain age, when they see it, they can identify with it because it's the little yellow apparatus mm-hmm. that you stick in a 45 record to make it spin. So yeah. when I show it to younger people, they don't
They're
have a clue.
They're like, what? What is this?
They don't have a clue on what that is. So World Spinning on a 45, this one is called the B-side because I previously did the A-side a few years ago and had a purchase for it. So I did a B-side. And it basically sort of references how music brings people together. This the power of music, even music, instrumental music. Is there something about music that can just bridge a gap and bring people together, no matter what your ethnic background is, no matter what color your skin is, no matter what neighborhood you live in, music has the power to unite people. So in the piece, when I use buttons as a language, right? So buttons help me tell the story within the piece. So when you look at it, a lot of times there's a lot of undercurrents in messaging in the piece. When if you just look at it face value, oh, it's beautiful, it's pretty. Mm-hmm. But it's more than that when you dissect it. So with this piece in particular, there's all kind of buttons that relate to, say, celebration, dancing. There's anti-war buttons. There's peace signs. There's these buttons with lullabies for kids on it. There's baby shoes, there's balloons, there's slices of cakes, musical instruments, musical notes. So it's helping me tell the story. So at some point within those buttons, you can relate to it. Because I'm taking a button out of its everyday existence, yeah. right? Because when we think of a button, we just think of a button as a fastener. And I say, when I get when a button reaches my hands, it's this final destination because I turn it into an art form. I turn it into something that you can view 50, 100 years from now. It'll be preserved rather than when it's on your clothes. You know, when you get tired of your clothes, people never think to take the buttons off of their clothes. They just toss it away. Right. And I'm a pack rat, so by the time I really release something, I always remove the button. Right? Then I have a castor iron bathtub.
I've seen this. It's a red. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So that's based on a poem by Ntozake Shange, which I had the pleasure of meeting before she passed on. She came to a few of our openings because the work was based on her work. So that's red poem number one. And if you see, you can go to PBS and you can see the PBS version of For Color Girl. And in that version, the actress Lynn Whitfield, she embodies that poem. And in the poem, she takes this lovely bath that she cleanses herself from a night out with this gentleman. So she cleanses herself in this potion. And in the potion, she describes all the stuff in the potion. So it's all things that glitter and sparkle. So I have stars, I have glitter buttons, I have moons. I have all these things, like a positive cleansing potion for this lady. And then her silhouette is in the tub. So again, the buttons have a language within themselves to help me project what I'm trying to say without saying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Know? There's a picture of you on your website with your tongue out, and your tongue is covered in buttons. It is a very striking picture. And I just wondered, is that Photoshopped or is that real? Or how did you do that?
Well, that's Photoshop. And I came up that with that concept because I said that I'm addicted to buttons. So it's like, you know, I'm swallowing buttons because I'm addicted to them like they're pills. So even with that, it's this, a story within that too. There's a 13 button on there. We call it the family 13. I'm born on March 13th. I have a cousin that's born on March 13th. My mom and her sister is February 13th. And my dad is April 13th. And then my dad's brother is January 13th. So we call it the lucky 13. So it's that 13 button. And then I have a Pisces symbol button, which I'm a Pisces. And then I found some designer buttons. I think there's a Pierre Cardin button and there's a Burberry button and another, but they all reflect who I am as a person. So there's just not a bunch of random buttons laying on my tongue.
I'm going to look at it again now.
And I always say that that's my boring headshot.
It's actually brilliant. I think like it's so memorable, you know?
Because I always say, like, when you see people's headshots, they're not memorable.
No, but this one, I mean, it's a great photo for sure. So that was a really good idea. And I wondered whether you ever feel confined by being known as the Button Man, like whether, because I know you have another line that you created called Triple T-Shirts, which is also very brilliant. And I'd love for you to tell us about that. I spent a lot of time staring at them and trying to understand how they were constructed and where you put your head and where the other heads are and everything. But they're very smart, but they have no buttons on them. So I just wondered whether that was in reaction to sort of maybe being confined as the Button Man.
Well, let me tell you about the Button Man. With the Button Man, I really don't feel confined with it. And it goes back to, you know, I've been working with buttons 40 years plus, right? And the interesting thing about buttons is it's, and I say this often, it's probably a million buttons across the world. And it's probably buttons that I'll never get my hands on. But every time I do a new project, I get a fresh set of buttons. It's not the same repetitive thing of I'm using the same buttons over and over and over again. And it keeps it interesting because I don't know what I'm going to find. And especially when, you know, when I go to these little flea markets and these little dusty rummy sales. And even when I go home to Philly and my mother has these little dirty bags of buttons that she finds, it's always some gems in there. And it's always something that I have never seen before. So that keeps me alert. It keeps me excited. So that's why, you know, that's why I have done it for so long, because it's new every time I open a bag of buttons. Now, getting to the triple T-shirt, I call that my beautiful mistake. Again, I'm one of those type of people. I'm a pack rat. It's hard for me to get rid of stuff. And I love T-shirts. So I had about... I had about maybe 100 or so, close to 100 or so T-shirts. And my partner said to me one day, and, you know, we're in New York City, so we're in these little spaces. He said, you have all these T-shirts. We're running out of space in here. What are you going to do with these shirts? So, you know, at first I was, you know, kind of offended. Like, you know, some of these shirts are my prized possessions. Would you want me to get rid of them? You want me to give them away? No, I'm not doing that. So, I went to see George Clinton a concert, and I bought a t-shirt, and I had previously had a t-shirt. So I just took the shirts and I sewed them together, wore them out, nothing happened. And then the next year, I went back to see George Clinton again, and I bought another shirt. And I added the third shirt to the two shirts. And when I tried it on, and I looked in the mirror, I said, oh, I think I have something. And I started playing around with them, you know, wearing it in different ways. And like you said, it's three head openings, it's four armpits. It's just a lot going on in this one shirt. So I went to my pile of shirts, and I started making these little narratives, these little stories out of the shirts. So there's just not random shirts being thrown together, just like with the button. I'm trying to tell a story within the shirt. So I have socially conscious shirts. I have sports. I have superheroes. What else? Pop culture. So it depends on what I find, just like the button, on what I can come up with. And they're all unique and they're all one-off. Just like the button, everything I do is a one-off. Even if I do like what the world's spending on a 45, I did too, but they're entirely different from each other. So I cannot repeat the same process in what I'm doing. And the same thing goes for them. It depends on, you know, what type of shirts that I'm buying. I'm sourcing shirts a couple times a week. And I don't put the shirts together immediately. Like in my apartment now, I probably have maybe about 75 shirts that are complete. And then I have piles and piles of shirts that are looking for mates to complete a story. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're all unique. I have them in three outlets in New York City. It's a place called Verse. My first location is a place in Brooklyn called Indigo Style Vintage. And then we have another store, Art to Wear. And Art to Wear, all the artists are upcycle, repurpose artists. So
yeah. And that one is run by Leslie Ware, who has been on this show in the past. And I love Leslie.
So. Yeah.
That's so awesome.
You know, that part of outside of the button, I love that too, because it's both categories are very special within themselves.
So when you are thinking about this retrospective exhibit coming up, and we should say it's at the Fuller Craft Museum, which is in Brockton, Massachusetts, how did that come about? And did you make anything new for this? I saw a piece I think it's gray, and you wear it over your head, and it has like,
oh yeah, that's a do-rag.
Spikes. Okay, yeah, but it's long. I mean, it goes down. It's almost like 6 feet. It's almost like a veil or a train.
Yeah, like a wedding veil. Right. Yes.
Yeah. So yes. Tell us about that piece. Is that new for this?
That's new. I did three. Well, the first one, we go to a lot of social events, art events, and part of our strategy in how to get in the room is you have to be seen in the room. So when we go to these different festivals and art events, you have to be seen. So we come up with all these different unique and sometimes really outlandish outfits. So immediately, as soon as we walk in the door, people are taking our pictures. They want to know what we do, where we're from,
smart,
and that type of thing. So it starts conversation. And I'll tell you another story later. But that started early on. Sometimes you just got people, get people to see you to start the conversation.
Right.
So I forget where we were going. And Solio said to me, what do you think of a button do-rag? And, you know, we have a lot of conversation back and forth about, you know, my craft and what I can produce and what I want to produce. So I thought about it. I was like, a button do-rag. Like, I didn't see the vision. So I sat with it for a couple of days and we went back to the conversation. And I said, you know what? I think that's a good idea. Went and got the fabric, got the do-rag made. And I was trying to figure out what type of button I could use to execute it, to just keep it simple but effective. So my mom gave me a couple bags of clear button that I hadn't used, and which I don't use everything right away. It has to make sense. So I got the bag of buttons and I started applying them. And this time I used shirting fabric, like a real heavy, strong cotton. And I did a little section. And with the clear button, there's no color. So it takes on the color of whatever it is that you're using, right? But the highlight of that button is the way it reflects light and the way it reflects movement. So when you're walking and you're moving, it just, it sparkles like the sky, like the moon. It sparkles like sequins. And then I got excited. I was like, oh yeah, I can do this. So I started and I created the first one, and then I had some buttons commissioned for Black hair care, and the do-rag is specifically for Black men, well, women too, but mostly men, is to train our hair and to have waves set in our hair in a certain pattern and style. So we wear those. And then over time, they became a fashion statement. At one point in time, it was like a lot of negativity around this hair care thing, which people who are not in the culture did not understand, you know, why these young Black men were going around with these do-rags on, whatever. So it's basically for hair care. So in recent years, they become fashion statements. So you'll see them in all kinds of patterns, all kinds of prints, all kinds of length, what have you, depending on the individual. So when I completed my do-rag, oh my God, it in some ways it reminds me of a wedding veil. It reminds me of something like ceremonial. You know what I'm saying? It gave me all I wanted and more. And then when Solio tried it on, I was like, that's it. So you know, we went to the event, networked. It did its job. Us getting attention and opening another door for us. So when Fuller came around, I created two more, right? Okay. So now how we got to Fuller during the pandemic. I created, oh God, maybe a half a dozen or more so works during the pandemic, because, you know, I could just focus. I knocked one thing out and just immediately went to the next thing. So Solio came up with the idea of we should get a reel and put all the works on a reel and reach out to institutions to see if they would be interested in seeing my work. Now, we didn't know how far it was going to go, what direction that it was going to go in, but we just wanted to open up a conversation. And in some of these institutions that we had approached in the past, but nobody wanted to talk, nobody had time to talk. So when the pandemic kicked in, right, it was all this idle time and people were sitting around trying to be busy and they had time to listen. So we reached out to several institutions and Fuller was one, and we met with them and we did the reel. I had never did a Zoom meeting before, and I was a little skeptical, a little apprehensive. And he said to me, "You're gonna be talking about yourself. You're gonna be talking about your work. So you know, just take it easy. Just go in and be the best you can be." So maybe about the third or fourth one, I was comfortable. So we got to Fuller, and I explained the work, and we went back and forth, and there was a lot of emails, there was a lot of dialogue. And I think maybe a month's time, they offered us a show.
That's awesome.
And then a lot of other doors start opening with other institutions. And
sure.
I always And to some degree, I still feel like I'm under the radar, right? And then with me being doing the wearables, so I'm in the fashion side of it, and the visuals, I'm in the art side of it. And right. then, you know, sometimes that collides, but it's just, it's two different worlds. And that's another reason that it keeps the work fresh. Because if I get bored in this side, I'll jump to the other side. And I just go back and forth.
Right. You know, blur, which is why defining yourself as a creative is so smart, because then those two sides are always open.
Yes. So I'm very much content in that world. With these other institutions that's interested now. When I first saw that first jar button, I had no idea that right. it was going to lead me to where I am right now. But the one thing I can say, it's really not about the destination. It's about the journey. Because in the journey, I've had a lot of highs and lows. In the journey, you know, I've learned a lot of things. In the journey, most of all, I stayed focused in the journey, because I never wanted to give up. But, you know, life happens, things happen, you get your little roadblocks. I stayed focused.
Yeah. And that's, I think, been one of the keys to your continued growth and success, is that focus. So I want to make sure that we get to your recommendations before we run out of time. This has been okay. really interesting. So you wanted to recommend a piece of music. It's the On and On album.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about that. Yeah.
It's Jose James. And again, as a kid, my parents listened to a lot of jazz. And I can remember going to one of my friend's house at the time, and his mother used to always say, "How do you know all these old songs? How do you know all this old music?" I'm like, "My parents listen to this." So, you know, I would be in their house and something would come on, I would start singing a song. She was like, "Do you know this song?" I'm like, "Yeah, I know this song. How do you know this song?" So, you know, it would be that kind of thing. So what Jose James is a new era of jazz, because his jazz is fused with hip hop. I have all of his albums to date. Mostly I diva worship, and diva worship is this female artist that gay men sort of gravitate to. So it's only like a handful of male artists that I absolutely love, and he's one of them. I got a chance to see him at the Blue Note last year, and On and On is a collection of Erykah Badu songs, and he puts his own spin on them. He takes him into another realm, another direction. It's like hearing the songs for the first time, right? Mm-hmm. And these are songs that I know. Back to Leslie. Leslie Ware. Her cousin works with Jose.
Oh, okay.
Right. So, I have triple T's that I call fives, which are five shirts that they hit the ground.
Wow. That's going to be like a flowing cape. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like having a bat wings or whatever. Right.
Amazing. Yeah.
So I said to her, do you think your cousin can get in contact with him for me? Because I made a special commission shirt for him, Erykah Badu shirt with all these different images of Erykah Badu. So he came to the Bloom Note and I got a chance to meet him. I gave him the shirt and he wore it in Japan, in one of his shows in Japan. So I was really excited about that.
So great. Yeah.
And I was excited because he's somebody that I love his music. So I just wasn't randomly, you know, just trying to jump on the bandwagon. But for anybody who's into jazz, you need to pick up that. It's a great album.
Great recommendation. And then we talked a little bit about Sandals earlier. But you also wanted to recommend some boots. They're Margiela Tabby boots, which are both comfortable. Which are both comfortable and stylish, you say. So tell us about these.
So I've been into Martin Margiela for a very long time. And he's another artist that started out upcycling and recreating things. So he still does that, but it's on a bigger scale. He no longer designs his own line now. Galliano is designer for Margiela, but it's reinterpretations of old garments. So I connect with that because that's basically what I do in my work, reinterpret whatever, right? Now, the tabby boot, he said he was inspired by the tabby shoe by the Japanese.
Okay.
With that little split toe that they wear with the, I forget the name of those sandals that they wear with just the two blocks of wood. Those.
Yep.
So.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at these boots right now. Yes. I've seen these before. They're so cool. Right. The toe is split almost like, almost like an animal's hoof in the front is what it reminds me of. Yeah.
Now, surprisingly, they are very comfortable. They are very, very comfortable. So to date, I have four pair.
Wow.
So I bought the first pair I bought was a gray suede pair, and they're really, really soft, nice gray, soft suede. And then I bought a basic black pair, and then I have another pair that's like an unfinished painted wall.
Mm, okay.
And then the last pair are like burlap, like a potato sack bag. And all of them are very, very comfortable. And they come in all different heights. They have heels, they have flats, they have midway. So I recommend them for somebody who, you know, wants to make a statement and be
make
stylish.
A statement, but still be comfortable, right?
Yeah, but still be comfortable at the same time. Because a lot of times, fashion is painful. The price of beauty is painful. So if you can find a way to fit in without the pain, then go for it. These would be something I would recommend to go for.
Well, Bo, this has been great. Thank you so, so much for sharing your story. And it's been really inspirational. Makes me want to go get out the jar of buttons that's in my studio. So I love talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Bye.
Bye. And you've been listening to the Craft Industry Alliance podcast. I'm Abby Glassenberg.
Today's episode was brought to you by Craftsy. Calling all crafters. Are you ready to dive deep into your favorite crafting projects and learn new techniques along the way? Then it's time to join Craftsy Premium Membership. Take advantage of this special promotion. For only $1.49, you'll receive a full year of access to expert-led tutorials, patterns, and projects in every category you can imagine. With a massive library of resources at your fingertips, you'll be able to create your best work yet and bring your crafting dreams to life. Don't wait. Sign up now at craftsyoffers.com and discover the endless possibilities of Craftsy Premium Membership. Thank you so much, Craftsy.
Craft Industry Alliance is a community for craft professionals. When you become a member of Craft Industry Alliance, you get in-depth coverage of craft industry news, the opportunity to connect with fellow professionals for advice and support, and access to an educational library filled with ideas, tools, and resources to help you as you build your business. Join us at craftindustryalliance.org. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.